Today is the 18th of October, and we're in the first chapter on non-self, or misconception of the self. So we've talked a little about this, and before I go on, I want to see if there's anything that you all want to bring up regarding what the previous classes.
Yeah, I have something.
Okay.
All right.
Speak closer to your...
Okay. Is this better?
Yes, that's much better.
All right, okay. It dawned on me that this text is really like a study in logic in a way. It reminds me of years ago, you know, reading an ethics class or being in a logic class where step-by-step analyses are presented to you and so on.
Yes.
But you had to accept the first premise. And in Aristotle and Augustus, no, not Augustus, Augustinian text, it was that you accept the fact that there was an unmoved mover.
Yes.
And that because of that, then followed all these other items. And I remember Joko talking about what led her to Zen was the fact that you didn't have to believe in something because you experienced something. And you faced your understanding and your commitment and so on upon this experienced understanding. Is that making any sense?
It makes sense. Now, you don't have to agree with anything that Yasutani Roshi says. Just simply take it as something to clarify, and if you don't agree with it, then you might ask what are the reasons I don't agree with, and what particularly don't I agree with?
Well, I basically agree with it. It's just I wish it were a little clearer.
A little what?
Clearer about... He comes to that at the end of this chapter where he talks about Kensho, I think. Yeah. I wish he had started from that point so that everything else followed from there.
Well, he's doing it his way, and actually he's doing it the way his teacher did it. And I don't know that we just are working with what we have.
Yeah, okay, all right.
So.
But that was a big realization for me this week is how he is presenting this. And if I think of it, really, it's Buddhist logic is what it is.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And you're free to, what should I say, disagree with or to question what he says or to say how and why you don't understand it or it's not clear or, you know, okay, he says it, but I don't find it useful that he says it. Now, we also have to remember, as I said, this is a translation of a text that's pitched to a certain audience at a certain time and space, and we're no longer the time and space, and yet we're trying to make the best use of it.
Gimyo?
Yes?
Someone here is asking what Kensho is.
Kensho is seeing true nature.
How is it, as the last paragraph says, it's the first step in Zazen. And, of course, Zazen is meditation. So,
well, what he's saying is that the first step in true Zazen, or, no, he doesn't say Zazen. He says, what he says is, subject is emptiness, object is emptiness, both are emptiness, and the intuitive realization, it should say of this fact, it says, or this fact, is called Kensho. Zen practice begins with Kensho, meaning that that's the fundamental, and that, true Zen practice grows out of Kensho. That's his way, that's his perspective. Now that's only one side, but that's the way he approaches it. And that's why in his style of practice, one begins first with breathing and then one begins with an initial koan. And there's an emphasis on staying with that until one has some sort of opening or realization, or as he says it, intuitive realization, no matter how small or big or it is. And then you just further deepen and work with that. He doesn't, it's on page 18 at the bottom. But he, in a sense, has explained it, but explanations are just explanations. See, in some sense, this is what Dogen says when he says to study the self is to forget the self, and to forget the self is to be awakened by the 10,000 things, and this awakening is dropping off or freeing or letting go of one's own body, mind, and that of others, and then that this realization goes on, or this awakening goes on endlessly. That's in Genjo Koan. Most of you are familiar with that, or at some point you've heard it. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you. I think it makes sense to the people that are here this evening that don't have books in front of them and are new to our group.
Yeah, it's very useful to either have the text on a virtual device or it's since you could find out where it is. It's posted on the website of the Zen Center, Prairie Zen Center, to download it and print it. It's, I don't know, 50 some odd pages, and you could do just 3 or 4 pages at a time. So it's no big deal. And, it might be a big deal, but hopefully it's doable. And it's useful to have the text in front of us, since we go back and forth with different pages and people bring up different things that they don't quite get. Notice, he goes on the very next, the end of the next paragraph, he says the study of emptiness is meant simply to cure, he says, first the bumpkin sickness, which is, he then explains, the attachment to the delusion of duality. And it's only a bumpkin sickness because of the consequences of believing that. So.
What page is that, Elihu, that you just referenced?
18, 19.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
And your machine is on, right?
My machine is on, yes.
Okay.
Multiple machines are on, and I assume they're working.
Okay.
Anything else? See, in at the beginning, at the top of page 18, he talks about, that a lot of this analysis is to help us clarify. He says prove, but I would say clarify that there is no fixed ego or self. Despite the fact that we've always assumed there is, this is to clarify that that's an assumption that creates trouble, and that's an assumption that's based on certain things which he's trying, showing how he sees that as being incorrect. And he uses different things, but we'll go on to the beginning of the next chapter, which is page 20, where he then further wants to clarify reasons or ways that he sees that this concept of I doesn't hold up. Now remember, earlier he attempted, on page 17, he attempted to clarify the different ways we make assumptions about I, whether we think it's somehow within our corporal body, or somehow it's larger than the corporal body, in other words, this body, physical body, and includes the body within it, or it's just the size of the body and exists along with the body, or it exists apart from the body. Now, as Heidi was saying, as Mjolnir was saying, this is a logical attempt to have us come to grip with it. But in a true sense, we don't have to do any of this logically. If we sit, we get to discover over and over our conceptions and the ways we assume things regarding self or I, in noticing where we get caught up, or where what we say to ourselves, or what we resist. If we clarify that, we see just for ourselves, not because we thought it out, but it, through our own experiencing, see where various ideas or assumptions about I cause trouble for us. So, again, it's not that there's anything wrong with saying I, or even identifying with I, whether so-called our body or so-called bigger, but it's what we clarify is to see that I, as a fixed, permanent, separate entity, is holding on to that creates trouble. So anything else regarding this chapter before we start part B of chapter 2, the part where common sense views of non-self regarding the misconception of self, or before we go to that, I want to make sure if you have any questions that you want to bring up, please don't hesitate. There is no wrong question or bad question. Whatever question you have that helps you clarify this, whether you agree or disagree, is valuable for you to share with others, because that supports both your practice and their practice, and our practice together.
So, Elihu, can you equate I with ego?
Yes.
Ego is difficult to, what is ego? Ego is what drives us, or ego is what gets people into trouble.
Yes.
If you can try to control your ego, then that's helpful, correct?
Well, one way, but another way is to, you don't have to control it, you just have to let go of holding on to it. So when it comes, and then if you don't hold on to it, it goes.
Right.
And if you notice when ego in the form of I like, I don't like, all sorts of self-centeredness is causing trouble or causing you to do things, once we become sensitive to that, then whenever it pops up, we can see that there's some sort of skillful and appropriate practice that might be called for. It's like if there's a particular food or spice that you react to. Some people have a reaction to cilantro, and it's whenever they taste it, for genetic reasons, they have a metallic taste in their mouth. So whenever there's a food with cilantro, if it's not too diluted, they tend to have that metallic taste, and that shows them, oh, there's cilantro here. Might be something else, not cilantro, but at least it's possible that there's cilantro here. I need to attend to this. So in one sense, when we have suffering or harming or upset, we know there's something to attend to. When we're caught up in something, in anger or sadness or greed or confusion, we know there's something that's called for here. We might not be clear on what to do, but then we at least can be noticing and be bodily experiencing and then sense or allow our presencing to inform and to clarify, or allow our zazening to clarify what's going on and what's so. Now, as I said, and as Johann said, Heidi said, that in some ways this, he's being logical here and using that to help us explore this. Of course, Zazen is not, doesn't require logically thinking this out, but this is a auxiliary to Zazen. So in the beginning of this chapter on page 20, he is again continuing with this I business, and he says, if our entire body were I, we would be able to control it however we wished. Yet the fact is that whether we like it or not, our body follows its own laws, changing from day to day, becoming old and finally dying. You could say you don't even have to go to becoming old. You could say becoming upset or becoming sad or becoming happy or becoming sick, despite the fact that I say I don't want to. So obviously, the body is not I, as Dogen says. Life goes with time and never stops even for a moment. So whatever I is, it's clear that though it's this physical body, and yet it clearly isn't this physical body, or that there is no I that we can... So then we can equate and that can control this. Then he goes to the next aspect of mind or mental processes. And so, and I like that just below that, on the next paragraph, the so-called I is purely nominal. Do people know what nominal means in that sense? It's the paragraph that begins, for example, the so-called absolute, the absentee landlord, the one who owns the land but does not live on that land, preferring to live elsewhere, does nevertheless live somewhere. But the so-called I, on the contrary, is purely nominal. In other words, he says, though we can't find the I, he's arguing that the I is totally imaginary. It's an illusion to which we are obstinately attached and is a constant source of unnecessary pain. See, that's an important point that he's trying to make. And he's doing this by, what should I say, teasing out all the possibilities and showing that this possibility doesn't work, and that possibility, it's not exactly our body, since it's not exactly our mind, and because we are so sure of the I in some way or another, because of how we speak of it and how we act based on it. In a way, you could say, why is he belaboring this so much? And the simple fact is that his belaboring is because we so often insist otherwise, and we can insist what we want, but we get into trouble otherwise, which is why there's a, or we create trouble for others. So, for instance, someone recently was telling me about the difficulty they were having with a teenage son, and that I shouldn't have to put up with that kind of speech or actions from my son. But if we hold on to that and act out of that, I shouldn't have to put up with it, as opposed to seeing what's skillful. It might be skillful to leave when they're acting a certain way, or it might be skillful to set certain boundaries, etc. But holding on to the idea, I shouldn't have to put up with this, and therefore I should be upset, etc., isn't skillful. It just creates more trouble for us if we believe that. So he then does an analysis first of the Renaissance, and then he does an analysis of capitalism, and then of communism. And we could talk about those things if you want. But I think for the most part, it's pretty clear what he says. You might disagree with it, in which case we can talk about that. And then he gets this third trend, what he calls railless ego supreme thought. I never heard that expression. It's a very interesting... That's at the bottom of page 21. It could be connected to some of modern trends about some of the anarchist protests in the streets of which result in all sorts of smashing, etc. You in the Midwest might not see much of that, but here on the West Coast, especially in the Bay Area, we see that happening often when streets are taken over, especially in places like San Francisco and the East Bay, Berkeley and Oakland, where they rampage through the streets just for the sake of it. And I shouldn't go into that too much more. Have you looked at his analysis, and is there anything you want to say or find useful or not useful about it? That's up to page 21.
I didn't find his analysis of history and political systems as particularly helpful. Because he's trying to make the case for no self, and then he goes off into whether these systems are ethical.
Well, yes. Well, he's trying to show how each of them emphasizes self in a particular way. I mean, of course, it's generalization, but how the various ways emphasize self in one particular way. Or certain particular aspects of self.
I know, but when you get into political systems, it gets to be really difficult, because all I can say is, okay, then you can make the statement that everything is transient, completely empty, but then you have to live in the in this, and I just don't know that I think that he should go there, quite frankly.
I think more than a historical political Christie here, he's really talking about different states of mind, the way that we see the world and see ourselves in the world. Whether we talk about the Renaissance and about capitalism and communism. I mean, we're really talking about states of mind and how we attach to self and how we see self in terms of materialism or idealism, whatever these things are. Or anarchism is his last example.
Yeah, but one wonders
when he gets to his final concept that all things are transient and completely empty, one wonders what kind of a system he would be able to operate if everyone realized that. To me, when you look at these different systems, either there's some slow realization that's going on, or this is always a constant realization for certain beings or whatever. I'm not sure that it helps, unless he's, you know, that's sometimes my struggle with this is, okay, I put a note right here where it says all things are transient and completely empty. I said, who wants to live like that? Even if life is an illusion, you know, I need to have some framework for life.
Who said life is an illusion?
Well, I mean, even if...
it's not about illusions, it's about attachments. You know, it's about the stories that we tell about self and others.
It always circles back to how one operates. If you practice every day to realize the transience and always changing, then what?
Well, actually, right below. Let me say, right below that, where he says that he has, there's a let's see, it's two paragraphs below. He says, in the middle of the paragraph, this is on page 22, the paragraph that begins heaven and hell. He says, when we realize the fact of egolessness, we are able to devote ourselves to others, and naturally all things become our friend. Consequently, we are be able to have a universal personality. Now, I never heard that expression before he used it, but, you know, that's an interesting expression. But that's his point. What is it to live with all things as our friend, as opposed to living, you know, let's say the trend where he talks about, you know, he simplifies it, but he says the trend of capitalism stressing material gain and not concerned about morality and not caring about others' problems, but just acquiring. Or, as he puts it, with communism, where in one sense it says, though he says there's some truth, but what happens is the self-centeredness gets connected to the party or to the state or to this some sort of ideal called the proletariat, but then it becomes a justification for all doing all sorts of other things.
Except that I just don't think he should go here, because if you study Marxism, it really was an ethical theory to make sure that no being wanted. So I was like, you know, just not sure.
But that isn't how any of it, that wasn't the way it was in any Marxist society.
No, but I mean, in theory... When I took Marxism in school, I mean, in theory, it was that, you know, people should receive what they need and no one should want.
Well,
yes, it's distorted in practice.
But that's the point. That's why he says, though it's somewhat better, but he says it lacks right ethics, and it, as he puts it, it's materialistic, but even more, it's based on a premise of self, which is the party, the state, or the proletariat, and that justifies mistreating all sorts of others. So in one sense, you've just expanded the self from the individual to other entities.
He didn't talk about socialism.
What?
I just want, he didn't mention socialism.
Communism and socialism are just the same.
In
terms of how they got, socialism is based on the same thing. It's just a question of how you put it into practice.
Right, which is the whole deal. I mean, how it's put into practice. I mean, you can have ideal capitalism, where everyone's equal, everybody has an equal chance, and no one's left behind. But that's not the way it works out. Just like it's not the way communism works out.
Yes. Now, of course, this is all generalizations, but his point is these systems emphasize some form of self-centeredness and, as he says, dualism, some forms of egoism that still create problems.
Well, the point he's making here is that whatever system we talk about, socialism, capitalism, whatever, the poison that distorts it is this I, this selfishness.
Yes.
Which is within the context that it manifests itself.
Yes. So that's why he says, when we realize the fact of egolessness, and notice he says, realize the fact, it's not the theory, but how do we see it for ourselves? That's the whole point. Which is why he says, this must be a practice. See, his emphasis is not on theory. He says that. Hearing is an explanation is not enough. Though it might be preparation for one's actual practice, it might be okay. But it's just theory then.
Again, this is Len, and I'm sitting here sort of processing the same things, and for me, the sort of cutting edge, if you will, of this, what he's doing in this chapter and again in the last one, has to primarily do, it seems to me, with that hard distinction we draw between self and other.
Yes.
Because the term ego has a lot of different definitions, and so I have to try to remember when I read this that he's thinking about that in the self, in the sense of the delusion that is putting myself first, as though any person can live in isolation, so to speak.
Absolutely.
And that worldviews, people who come up with different worldviews, whether it's in the political realm or it's in the religious realm, they might do so for all the right reasons, but because people bring different levels of understanding to what they hear, those do get distorted through the lens of always me first. So I don't know if that's if I'm on the right track there with that as a cutting edge, but for me, I have to set aside terms that I might define differently, whether it's political systems or the notion of ego functions or whatever, and think about what he's trying to get here is that the idea that there is an object, me, a self that's so separate from everything else in the world, when you look at that carefully, you begin to see how that can't possibly be the way it is.
Yeah, not just separate, but opposed to.
Yeah.
Threatened by, such as.
You have to speak closer, Mushin, to the...
Sorry. I say not just separate from, but opposed to. Yeah.
And his point, I mean, he makes the point that this is all as an encouragement for us to do what's required, whether you call it the fact of egolessness, which is, remember, this is a translation from another language, close to 75 years ago, that he says, he emphasizes it's a matter of realizing this for oneself in order to be able to then what he calls be a universal personality. Now, that's a fancy word, and I don't know if that's the best word, universal self, but whether to say let go of misconception of ego or awaken true self, which is no other than universal self. Those are very fancy words because then we get ideas of that. But he's trying to make clear that even though he's saying that, at the same time, that's not anything other than transient and completely empty. That's why he quotes both Buddha or in this case, the Song of Enlightenment by Yoko Daishi. See, that's an important point that he's trying to make. You don't have to agree with the things he says, but that's the way he's approaching this, and then he's going to build on that in different ways.
I think it's...
You have to speak close. I can't...
I think what feels more true to me is constant change.
Well,
I have difficulty with... no ego, empty. I just view it, to me, it's more everything flows in constant change. It may be even together, all interacted, but I just always have had the accepting no ego, no what's more real is just
right.
It's always a flow that interacts, cause and effect, multiple ripples, but it's still separate yet whole.
Well, so. And that's why I always, when he says no ego or no I always say no fixed, permanent, separate I or ego, which is what we assume. When we use the word, or when we, better yet, think of I as some sense of fixed, permanent, separate. And that's the issue that creates trouble. Otherwise, I'm speaking now. Fine. But if I'm speaking is that it's I who am telling you who someone separate, and that I that was the same I as 1 year ago, and it will be, and et cetera, et cetera, that gets us in trouble. But of course, that's too much to say. And maybe the word ego wouldn't be the best word, but, you know, that's what the translator used. So remember, he didn't say these words in English. This is what someone that translated it, and but still, of course, they were quite cognizant of what he was trying to say, and used what was to the best of their knowledge as someone who spoke English as a second or third language, the best way to translate that at that time. Maybe ego isn't the word you'd want to use now in the 21st century, or even at the end of the 20th century. But notice, Joko always uses caught and self-centered. Ego is another way of saying self-centered.
He's not saying that this sense of self, this sense of selfness. He's not saying it's something that we have to repress or destroy. He's saying it's something we just need to clarify and see through.
Well, we need to be cognizant of it, because sometimes when we assume it, see it, feel it, we assume that it's something other than transient and empty. We assume that it's, as I said, fixed, permanent, separate in some way. And
excuse the analogy of the bubble in the air, or am I thinking someplace else?
What?
Oh, I was reading somewhere else then about someone used the analogy of the bubble. We don't need to burst the bubble of the ego. We just need to see through it.
Well, it's also bubbles come and go. Bubbles don't stay.
Yeah. Different bubbles every day.
Bubbles pop up and
boiling troubles.
And no, they pop up and they disappear, but then they're capable of popping back up. There's no problem with bubbles coming and going. Because bubbles have no fear of, just because I cease being a bubble for a moment, it doesn't mean I won't be a bubble again in another way, because the bubble just fades into the water, so I'm in the water. I'm not gone. I'm just not a bubble at the moment. See, even at the end, at the very last sentence of this, next to the last sentence, the last paragraph of this chapter, which is page 23, when he says, afterwards we must practice diligently to get rid of our bad habits and to polish ourselves, I would see, in a way, you might not want to say to get rid of our bad habits, because then we think we have these bad habits, as opposed to letting go of bad reactions that arise, or saying it a different way. Because some of us would take, oh, I have all these bad habits I have to get rid of. Really, you have no bad habits except when they appear. Then it's a reaction that has its harmful and suffering consequences for you or for others. Then you can not so much get rid of it as stop holding on to it. So it's a slightly different way of saying it, but in a sense, saying it that way allows it to see that we're just polishing the jewel that we are. See? And I'm not saying something that someone else hasn't said before. Dogen in someplace talks about our life as one bright jewel, and he has a phrase, the more you polish it, the more it shines, but it's always this bright jewel, a bright pearl, Dogen says. And I don't remember what it's called. One Bright Pearl is the chapter, the fascicle, but I don't remember the Japanese name of it. It might be Ippo, but I might be wrong. Anyway.
Elihu, the paragraph right above this last paragraph.
Yes.
It says, that is to say, we must see the reality of human nature. We must break through our misconception of ego. We must awaken our true self, which is no other than universal self.
Yes.
I mean, he's mentioned this a couple of times.
Yes.
I have a little bit of difficulty understanding universal self.
Right. Well,
what is it?
I don't know. I mean, he's using that word, but I would say the universe which is our life, or the universe which is ourself, which means whatever we encounter is this universal self, as opposed to some self outside our body-mind. If you remember, that's one of the things he made clear, it's not what we're talking about. But in a sense, what he's saying is a self that isn't limited by our conceptions, but is everything that we encounter. And it's therefore a self which isn't separate, fixed, permanent, and therefore can arise and disappear according to circumstances. But he's going to talk about that in a future chapter. So, because the very next chapter is called Eternal Life, which is subtitled Life as a Wave. And I've talked about that before. So it's very good that you bring that up, Mary, because that's a perfect place to end and see whether what he says next week is useful in terms of the chapter 3, Life as a Wave, Eternal Life. And we have to be, again, this is translation, and when we say some of these words, we think it means what it means in English when some of the connotations of those words. So therefore, wait till you've read the chapter, which begins on page 24. So we should read that chapter next week, and let's end at this point. But know that whatever you have about the previous chapter, we can start with that before we go to this chapter. Okay?
Okay.
Yes. Thank you all.
All right, good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.